Your Honors.
Good morning.
Jim Haley for Appellant Hardy. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, this is an appeal where the parties essentially agree on the facts, the applicable law, and the fact that error occurred below. The question really for the court is, what should be the consequences of that error? To define the error specifically and to place it in some context, error occurred, as my brief mentions, during the prosecutor's closing argument. Said argument followed an evidentiary portion of the trial in which the accused, Defendant Hardy, had exercised his right not to testify. It had been testified to at trial by Detective Mullen that Hardy, when confronted by Mullen, had denied raping Ms. Seymour. Per Mullen, he never denied having sex with her, simply denied the sex was non-consensual. In his closing,
was your client's credibility, even though he didn't testify, was his credibility still an issue?
I would say the credibility of that statement was an issue, certainly, Your Honor. Okay. But beyond that, his character, for truthfulness or untruthfulness, I would submit, was not in evidence because he had not taken the stand, put his hand on the Bible, and taken an oath. So in his closing argument, the prosecutor did three improper things. He said that Hardy had lied to him, told him they did not have sex with Ms. Seymour, when DNA evidence collected at the hospital thereafter showed he had had sex with her. So he set up a false straw man that he didn't have sex with her, and they knocked that down because I've got DNA here that says he did have sex with her. Calling Hardy a falsifier based on an improper report of what Hardy had said to Mullen, supposedly. Second point of error, improper argument, Your Honors, was that he did launch a character attack against Hardy based on his alleged past. He called him a drug addict, a shoplifter, and a liar based on alleged past, his past nature. Even though, again, Hardy had not testified or sworn to tell the truth in any fashion. Lastly, the prosecutor vouched for the state's case, saying, in effect, we screen out falsely reported rapes. Ladies and gentlemen, you can trust that the case that we're bringing here to you today is true because we screen out falsely reported rapes, vouching for a credibility case without much corroborating evidence on that case in front of the jury. That's all acknowledged by the state, I would submit. The law, again, is also acknowledged by both parties.
Those facts are acknowledged, but you mentioned earlier that the state agreed that it was error.
Yes.
What part of those claims that you just made does the state actually agree are error?
The state agrees that, number one, was mischaracterization of Hardy's remarks to Bowen when confronted, saying it was a rape when it was actually denying a sex when he actually all he denied was rape, concedes that. The state, I see no opposition to the impropriety of the remarks about him being a drug addict and shoplifter and a liar in the past.
Maybe I misread their brief, but I thought while they would agree that factually what you claim occurred, I didn't get the impression they agreed that it was error, nor did I get the impression that they agreed it was, more importantly, reversible error.
Yes.
Now, didn't they, for example, argue that the defense interjected the issue of Hardy's past by comments about the fact that he was involved with drugs and he's not the kind of person you'd want in your house at Christmas or any other time, for that matter, words to that effect. And their argument, as I read it, was that door was open and we simply went through it.
They did say that, Your Honor.
Well, let's be clear on where the parties agree there was error and where there was not.
Okay.
And then let's talk about the standard of analysis that should apply. Are we talking about the Hughes test? Are we talking about Wainwright? To what extent is this an attack on the judicial process as opposed to the trial process? So Hunter's involved. Just what framework for analysis do we bring to bear on this case?
Well, the framework that the state has outlined in its answering brief, I would submit, is the appropriate one as far as how to deal with improper argument under Hughes, Your Honor.
Well, why does Hughes apply? There was no objection. There was no interjection sua sponte.
There was no objection.
Why isn't it Wainwright in plain error? Why is Hughes involved at all? Anybody read Baker?
I have it, Your Honor. I have not. My impression was that we show the error through impropriety of the comments, and then.
Well, isn't there an important distinction in our analysis based on whether or not the defense objected and whether or not the trial judge, who was, after all, present when it occurred, believed that given the context of the situation, it was necessary for the trial judge to intervene? Now, in circumstances where we're asked to second-guess the tactics of defense counsel, we get very cautious.
Yes.
So maybe you can explain to me, if this was such egregious error, why defense counsel didn't object.
Right. And I expected that would be the main point here, Your Honor.
So when defense counsel doesn't, and it's clear they didn't, shouldn't we take the position they had some tactical reason not to, and that the trial judge, him or herself, I don't know who the trial judge was here, concluded after hearing it that there nothing occurred that couldn't be cured by the final instructions to the jury?
I would acknowledge that as ultimately what plain error appears to be when there's no objection by the counsel below. And I would submit, Your Honor, that we don't have a replay of defense counsel's mind here during the trial. And the problem is that when error, improper argument, I submit, occurs repetitively, I'm not trying to excuse defense counsel for not standing up and objecting either during the mystery
and
or afterwards.
My comments aren't meant to criticize defense counsel. They're meant to point out that it's dangerous for us to second-guess tactical decisions that are made by counsel.
Right.
And that we have to assume that competent defense counsel had a reason not to object, because, quite frankly, this conduct is so egregious in one sense and so typical of the cases that speak to prosecutorial misconduct, one has to conclude it's obviously error. The question is, since it wasn't objected to, what, if anything, do we do about it? And I suggest to you that the approach may be to look at Baker, which tries to bring all the cases together and distinguish between a Hughes test, the Wainwright plain error test, and then the effect that Hunter might have after you conclude Hughes doesn't apply here, even if you conclude that the error was plain and you decide that the trial itself isn't a problem. You still have to look at Hunter to determine whether this, particularly the comment about we don't prosecute anything but anybody unless they're guilty kind of inference, that isn't this an attack on the integrity of the judicial process? It is, after all, the same type of comment that caused reversal in Hughes. So where are we? Tell me how we should be analyzing this case.
Yes, Your Honor, and I have to acknowledge, Your Honor, that at this moment, on the precedent Your Honor cited, I'm not fluent enough with that precedent to give Your Honor a sophisticated argument about those precedents and distinguishing them right here on the fly, so I won't try to snowball the court in there.
Well, why don't we start with the easy part?
Sure.
Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that because there was no objection, we're not looking at the Hughes test. What we're looking at is Wainwright plain error.
Right.
Why was what you just cited as error, plain error, that would necessitate a remedy that might include reversing the conviction?
What I would submit, Your Honor, is that the repetitiveness of what's happening here, to me, plain error suggests that there's no harm, no foul, or that it's so modest and insignificant that it's subject to a fudge factor, and this falls into the fudge category, and we'll just fudge it. But when it happens repetitively here, I would submit the attack on what Hardy said, broadening the attack to his character, and then the vouching that. It does rise to the error to me of that a simple mitigation recital, which Your Honor gives and the court gives in every trial. The Hunter case says if something happens repetitively, it's worse. And when Hardy has not testified and he's not directly placed his character in evidence, I would submit, and yet the prosecutor seeks to inflame the jury against the man by talking about his character, and then says, you can also trust me, in contrast, because, you know, I'm wrapped in the law of the prosecutor's office, and trust me, we don't let bad cases come to this court. We screen out the false ones. I can't go beyond if it when you see it kind of thing, or whether it's that kind of standard here for the court about when it rises to becoming so plain that we know it when we see it. But what I gather from reviewing the transcript and from what I've tried to argue here to the court today is that continually banging on credibility in that fashion, posing the prosecutor as the credible one in the courtroom, makes it plain. And I'm sorry it's much more sophisticated than that, Your Honor, but that's how I've seen the matter.
Well, plain error is a pretty general concept.
Yes, Your Honor.
It runs throughout all the cases, not just cases that are allegedly prosecutorial misconduct, which brought us here today. What is our focus when something has gone wrong at trial under a plain error analysis that would lead us to conclude no harm, no foul, or on the other hand, that we can't overlook this error and therefore there has to be a remedy? And does the remedy go so far as to say the only plausible remedy is a reversal and a new trial? What tips the scales? What do we look at?
Yes, Your Honor. And I've been thinking to myself, what balances the seesaw, and how can I tell the court to predict how the seesaw will balance in the future so they can repeat this process and do it predictably in the future for trial lawyers in the future and for itself? And I don't know what to say beyond it doesn't pass the smell test. The court knows it when it sees it.
Well, why should we have confidence in the outcome here where a defendant was convicted of rape and the prosecutor says to the jury in closing rebuttal, not where there's a chance for anyone to respond, that we don't prosecute bad rape cases. They fall along the way. We only, in effect, prosecute guilty people. And then the jury convicts the defendant of rape. Under a plain error analysis, what's the significance of that?
Well, it's, again, it raises the question, and I think the state cannot reasonably answer the question, that the jury has shifted, the focus of the jury has been shifted from the evidence to the prosecutor as, prosecutor, judge, and jury, that, I've already decided this case for you, and trust us.
What about the evidence of rape apart from that comment? How does that play a role in the analysis?
Again, two persons involved in the interaction, Mr. Hardy and Ms. Seymour, no other witnesses, any kind of force being used against Ms. Seymour, no trauma, trauma perhaps suggesting that she may have been struck.
Did she testify, the witness, the victim?
She did.
So she testified that she'd been raped?
That she had been raped, that she had been struck with an object, a pipe of some sort,
right,
and had been forced to engage in relations with Mr. Hardy.
And there was testimony by people that treated her afterwards?
There was, and there was some sign of trauma, I believe, on a limb, Your Honor. Nothing vaginally, from what I recall, in the evidence as I reviewed it, Your Honor. And the problem that these two, no dispute, were intimate on a long-term basis. Intimacy had supposedly stopped per Ms. Seymour at some point in the past or recent past, but they were not strangers to each other. They were intimate on a long-term basis, boyfriend and girlfriend. In that kind of case, again.
So it was a he said, she said, except there was objective evidence of force being used and injury to the victim.
Right. The freshness of that appearance of trauma to the limb, I don't know, but there was suggestion that she said she had been hit with a pipe, and there was a pipe found at the scene. And
your argument is that, in a he said, she said situation, the only tiebreaker was the statement by the prosecutor that said, trust me, we only prosecute guilty people. But isn't it the case that there's another tiebreaker, and that is the proof of force being used on this woman?
Well, and that proof, Your Honor.
Is that right?
There was evidence of some injury, Your Honor. Now, the timeliness of when that injury occurred, is unclear. Going to what Mr. Capone may have opened the door to, at some point he says Mr. Smith refers to these drug addicts fighting over the last bag of drugs, don't they? Which is not perhaps a nice comment to make, but I would submit that what the force actually showed in the case, Your Honor, was not totally clear.
I'm not sure what you just said.
Sure. At some point, Mr. Capone mentioned in his closing argument that, you know, how do we know what really happened here? Do drug addicts often fight over the last bag of drugs? And what really happened here? Maybe she got struck.
Was he arguing that she was hit by a truck?
No, Your Honor, I don't know beyond he was trying to undermine the idea that any sense of force being used necessarily was about sex, is what he was saying.
And well, the trial judge gave an instruction about the statements that the attorneys make were not evidence. The attorney's role was to zealously and effectively advance the claims of his party and only consider the evidence. Why doesn't that cure the error?
Well, Your Honor, the problem occurs, I would submit, Your Honor, when the argument, improper argument, is repetitive. The mitigation instruction is looked to what was done to mitigate the improper argument under Baker. But when it happens repeatedly, the question becomes, will a simple mitigation, simple recital about don't take these attorneys' statements seriously, they're not evidence, psychologically perhaps, you know, how effective is that when someone has done something repeatedly on a credibility case, bolstering credibility improperly, attacking the defendant's credibility improperly, that a simple recital, I would submit, of a mitigation is not necessarily satisfactory when it happens repeatedly.
So it's a cumulative effect test that you would advocate?
Yes, Your Honor. And His Honor, Justice Steele has pointed out that perhaps more so than I really appreciated that the vouching puts it in a different league to the extent that we're no longer talking about what witnesses said or didn't say, but you can trust me because I only bring, you know, guilty cases to you, ladies and gentlemen.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the State. Your Honors, if I may begin, certainly the State has acknowledged that the vouching that took place in this case was misconduct. There should be no question about the State's position on that. Also, the State certainly acknowledges that the prosecutor's representation to the jury in rebuttal closing of the defendant as a liar was not appropriate. Either. Essentially, because that is...
Did the prosecutor also misrepresent the defendant's statement to the police?
Your Honor, that the statement regarding how Detective Mullen had questioned Mr. Hardy, from the record... It was not. I cannot say, Your Honor, that is the logical conclusion, that denying that a rape took place also meant denying that sex took place.
I'm sorry. Is your answer to that question yes or no?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I am not comfortable with the prosecutor's representation of Detective Mullen's testimony.
How does that help us? Did he misrepresent or not?
Your Honor, I cannot get into the prosecutor's mind and say whether he was intentionally misrepresenting or not. I can only say I would not have been comfortable with making that sort of statement.
Well, his comment was inaccurate, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And one could infer it overstated what was actually said in a way that favored the State's case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether it was done intentionally or not. What you're uncomfortable with is being able to say that he intentionally misrepresented it as opposed to just getting it confused in the heat of the moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And as Your Honor observed, certainly these are not subtleties that took place in the rebuttal closing. These are very obvious sort of things. And what is troubling here is the fact that, given how obvious they were, that defense counsel at trial did not object, especially when it's certainly a very experienced defense counsel who was active throughout the case, objecting 9 times, but yet not objecting here. It's hard to think that this is anything other than a strategic decision. Obviously, without having an affidavit from defense counsel, I can't say I know that that was a strategic decision by defense counsel.
Well, our case law suggests that we don't want to get into that because we don't know when it is a tactical decision with purpose or when it isn't. So that isn't that why it shifts to a plain error analysis?
Yes, Your Honor.
And under Wainwright, how should we analyze this case?
Oversight is the biggest question. And was this something that was overlooked through inadvertence or not? Certainly we'd be in a different position right now.
Well, let's just, you know, make sure that we're clear on our terms here. I understand what you said in response to the Chief Justice's question to be that there was plain error. Now, the question then becomes, was that reversible? Either it is or it isn't. Why shouldn't we reverse and remand for a new trial?
Your Honor, here, essentially because the case actually was very strong against Mr. Hardy, and it makes... I don't know how to put a very fine point on it. It makes the prosecutor's statements that much more inexplicable. There was no question that sexual relations had taken place between the complaining witness and the defendant. And then there was in addition to the objective scientific evidence that sexual relations took place, there was the examination by the sexual assault nurse examiner, finding the bruising that was consistent with the metal pipe that was found. So the difficulty is there's in fact very substantial evidence to support a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
As a matter of interest, go ahead. This reference to the metal pipe is interesting. I doubt there are many homes in Delaware where one would not find a metal pipe. Was there some way in which this metal pipe was actually linked to the injury?
Your Honor, there was no fingerprints on the metal pipe.
Any DNA from the pipe from the complaining witness?
No, Your Honor. To the extent that there is, I believe, the pattern of bruising would be consistent with the size of the pipe. I think
there was testimony to that effect?
Your Honor, if I can direct the court's attention.
Well, it's not that important.
Okay.
You check the record later. I just, when we're looking for corroboration in analyzing under plain error whether or not we should be comfortable with the outcome of the case, whether or not there's sufficient evidence that makes whatever error occurred in effect not be that substantial because we have confidence in the outcome. Having some corroboration of the he said, she said case, particularly when it's conceded that they had sexual intercourse on a regular basis, and as I understand the facts, at least 3 times that very night that the rape was alleged to have occurred, it becomes more important to link force by whatever method to the circumstances of the evening, and it seems to me that metal pipe would be critical to making that linkage.
Yes, Your Honor, and that pipe, again, all I can represent to the court is certainly that the complaining witness testified to it. Such a pipe was found at the scene, and that the sexual...
Well, for example, was the pipe shown to her, and then she say, yes, that looks very much like or is the pipe that he struck me with. Did that occur?
From having read the record, Your Honor, I do not believe That's not something I recall from the complaining witness's testimony.
Well, what was the testimony, if there was any, that linked the pipe to the bruises?
The sexual assault nurse examiner's description, I believe. At A54.
And what summarized what was the testimony?
Your Honor, just that the bruising found on, I'll say the hip, thigh, buttocks area was consistent with being struck by a pipe.
And the pipe was found where? In the bedroom?
Your Honor, I believe this was essentially an abandoned property. I could not tell you where in that property it was found, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't actually believe from the record it said in what room it was found.
Okay, so if this is plain error analysis and there is conceded error, at least in part, help us be comfortable with the outcome. Tell us why we should have confidence that whatever prejudice there was not so unfair that it forces a reversal.
Your Honor, certainly defense counsel acknowledged the unhealthy relationship that the complaining witness and the defendant had in this case. Again, being no question about sexual relations taking place and the pipe supporting it. I guess, furthermore, the fact that the jury was still able to carry out its function by finding a lesser included offense of unlawful imprisonment as opposed to a kidnapping and returning a verdict of not guilty as to attempted rape.
But they did convict him of rape.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's the state's position that by clearly the jury was not so caught up in the prosecutor's improper rebuttal that it ignored its own function. It still weighed the evidence and, in fact, acquitted
Mr. Smith
of a charge.
Can't this case fairly be characterized as one where the evidence on either side or both sides is an equipoise? I mean, on the one hand, you have the witness, the victim's testimony that she was forced to have sex, and there were bruises, which a witness testified were consistent with a pipe that was found on the scene. On the other hand, you had the defendant's denial in a pretrial statement that there was forcible sex, coupled with the fact that this couple had sexual relations on a regular basis and had sex three times that night. So, you know, one could argue that this was a close case. And if that, to the extent that's correct, didn't the prejudicial statement by the prosecutor tip the balance unfairly?
Your Honor, that would be a very understandable interpretation if the court found that.
Well, that's the defense's interpretation. What's yours? Why shouldn't we accept that characterization, of this fact pattern here?
Your Honor, unfortunately, I cannot offer anything more to you than I have regarding the pipe and the testimony of the sexual assault nurse examiner.
Well, let's talk about one related and one additional issue. Let's assume that if Justice Jacobs' characterization of the facts were correct, for the sake of argument, it would explain why the prosecutor thought it necessary to misstate what Hardy said to the police officer about not raping her as opposed to not having sex with her. It would also explain why he thought it was necessary to tell the jury in a closed case that the Attorney General's office simply doesn't prosecute innocent people, that false rape claims fall by the wayside, inferring that only valid rape claims go forward, and that the defendant was a drug addict and a liar while he was exercising his constitutional right not to put his credibility to proof before the jury, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, that's I understand that that would be a very fair way of considering things.
Well, the problem is I'm not sure it is a fair way of considering it, and that's the dilemma that we face. We're trying to, not having been there, we're trying to get a sense of what's going on. If that were true, if that were the context of the entire trial, it boggles the mind that the trial judge relied solely on an instruction at the end of the case that speaks to tell the jury, consider only the evidence that comes before you, not the way in which the attorneys interpret the evidence, because the vouching statement by the prosecutor has nothing to do with evidence at all. That instruction doesn't speak to that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It also doesn't speak to the attack on whether the defendant's a liar or a drug addict or not, because that's not part of the evidence that goes to the charges. That's simply a statement about his character. So that brings me to the next question, and that is, if indeed this is a Wainwright plain error case, and even if we were to analyze the facts and conclude that we can be comfortable with the jury's analysis because they did, as you point out accurately, appear to have carefully gone through the charges and select what they thought was made out by burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt and what was not, and made their judgment accordingly, do we still have an issue under Hunter of whether or not the integrity of the judicial process was compromised by this prosecutor's misconduct? Because the vouching is an incredibly egregious statement that it's almost unfathomable could happen in Delaware. It speaks directly to the problem in Hughes when the prosecution tried the same tactic. And attacking the character of witnesses or vouching for one's own case is repetitively spoken about in our case law. Is this prosecutor just not familiar with Delaware case law?
Your Honor, certainly that the trial deputy was not a new prosecutor, and I would certainly expect he is familiar with case law.
And he's familiar, no doubt, with the many times in the cases where we talk about how much more difficult the situation is for us when the prosecutor makes these comments in rebuttal closing, where there's no opportunity for the opposing counsel to address it if it is an issue of fact that can be addressed.
I agree with Your Honor.
Well, then the question becomes, and I ask you this as in your position as an officer of the court, if we're troubled by this, what can be done short of a reversal if we're comfortable with the verdict in this case? If our conclusion were to be, we've analyzed the rest of the evidence, we're comfortable with the verdict, we're confident that despite the prosecutorial error, it should not affect the jury's judgment, what do we do about these kinds of comments? Give us confidence that simply writing our 37th opinion talking about these things is going to be good enough to stop this from happening in the future.
Your Honor, certainly, as the court most recently stated in Baker, it has the option of making a referral for discipline to either the Attorney General or to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. And Your Honor, I think it's fair to say collective punishment is not always the best way to go. An individualized focus of error may be a more productive remedy. And I would just beg that Your Honor not press me further on that point.
No, I understand I'm putting you in an uncomfortable position. That's why I asked you to respond as an officer of the court, so anyone in your office would know you had no choice but to respond to the question as a disinterested member of the bar. It's very difficult for us to
to see what we see on the record here and understand how it can happen after all the cases that have been written, and I'm sure all the internal memorandums that have been sent and within the office warning people, and when it still occurs in a case where at least one way of looking at the case is that it's a close case, it makes us suspect that the prosecutor knew what he was doing and overreached because he needed to get the conviction. That's a very troublesome way of looking at it, but it can't be completely discounted. I've never seen a case where a prosecutor says false rape claims fall by the wayside, inferring that we only prosecute claims that are valid. And in effect, we believe the complaining witness here, where in many other cases we don't. In a case where it's the complaining witness's word about what happened versus a defendant who's elected to exercise his constitutional right to simply deny the offense. We would have to be comatose not to be troubled by that.
Your Honor, the state certainly does not suggest that this court should not be troubled. I hope I have not.
No, I understand your point is the remedy isn't to reverse. There is something short of that if we are troubled by the conduct here, and not to let the conduct here trump what is otherwise a valid conviction. That's basically your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand that.
Okay.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Your Honors, I heard Your Honor refer again to Wainwright. Your Honor, I apologize that Wainwright's not at my table. If Your Honor wants me to submit written argument or memorandum post, I will.
Wainwright in the arena of plain error is like Miranda. It's just so standard, so common, so well known.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then Baker is the latest, in quote, greatest, close quote, of our prosecutorial misconduct cases. It was an attempt to bring it all together to distinguish when Hughes is the test, when Wainwright is the test, and how Hunter comes to play in each of those two tests. So,
yes. On a fine point, Your Honor, that was discussed with Mr. Smith, namely bruising and, quote, consistent with the pipe. The evidence of bruising was found by a trauma nurse at the ER within, I think, 24, 48 hours of this event allegedly occurring. She did not see a pipe, so there's no testimony that that bruising looks like a pipe caused that bruising. There's no such evidence submitted medically, expert-wise, in the trial. It was simply that a third party, a nurse, trauma nurse, found some bruising and scratching on.
Okay, so the complaining witness said she was struck with a pipe, and that's what forced her to engage in sexual conduct, which is the basis for the rape.
Yes.
There was some confirmation by a medical professional that bruising was found in the area of the body that she had identified.
Correct.
But there was no testimony linking either the metal pipe that was found as the instrument that did the bruising or that the bruising was consistent with a blow inflicted by a metal pipe. Is
correct.
That what you're saying?
Exactly, Your Honor, just to clarify that point. So, again, it's really her word that certainly the object is a sign of injury. Don't dispute that. She was some kind of contusion on her. But the cause of that contusion, how it came to be, and as a, you know, forced to have sex again, is strictly on her word. And so it is a credibility case. There's a victim here, Ms. Seymour, alleged victim, who in some ways wasn't a real reputable person herself. And I think I submit the prosecutor saw Mr. Capone, the trial counsel, defense counsel, going after and diminishing that person in some way. And so he thought, you know, I got to balance the scales here. And he goes after Hardy as his character and then says, well, hey, if both these folks aren't too reputable folks, you can trust me. I'm the prosecutor. There are false rapes. We screen them out. What you have in front of you is one I brought to you, ladies and gentlemen.
So, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.